to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
In today's program, scholars of the UO Class of 2021, Our Future is in Good Hands, we look at the work of three students at the University of Oregon.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, Lane County, and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's May 14th, 2021 program. Our Future is in Good Hands, scholars of the University of Oregon Class of 2021. This is the 33rd program of our 2020-2021 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page, and are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 on Mondays at 7 p.m. In today's program, scholars of the UO Class of 2021, Our Future is in Good Hands, we look at the work of three students at the University of Oregon, Anastasia Browning, Jaira Johnson, and Jude Stone. Anastasia Browning is a psychology major and works as a research assistant at the Social and Affective Neuroscience Lab and the Cognitive Dynamics Lab in the Department of Psychology. Jaira Johnson, an anthropology and linguistics major, is a winner of multiple scholarships and a research assistant in the Primate Morphometric Lab. Jude Stone, a political science major, has spent the last couple of years working as an administrative assistant in Clark Honors College and an education and activism coordinator for the LGBTQ3A Alliance at the University of Oregon. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website. I would like to thank Mary Layton for coordinating today's program. Near the end of every school year, the University of Oregon showcases the work done by undergraduate scholars with the support of the Center for Undergraduate Research and Engagement in a public research symposium. We often think of university as a place where a community hands down the knowledge and wisdom of the ages. In this program, we are reminded that knowledge creation is, and always has been, also the mission of universities, and undergraduate students can participate. In this third annual celebration of their remarkable achievements, City Club of Eugene presents a sample of young researchers' work. Their presentations are a parting gift to us as they graduate and head off to change the world.
All right, so as Scott mentioned, I'm a graduating undergraduate psychology major at the University of Oregon. My name is Anastasia Browning, but I kind of wanted to share with you a little bit about my journey here before getting into the details about my research work and interests, because it's definitely not your traditional one. So I identify as a non-traditional student, specifically because I returned to, or I should say I began my academic career later in life. I'm 36 now, and I intend to continue through academia in pursuit of a PhD in clinical health psychology after graduating with my very first bachelor's at the University of Oregon. I think it's important that I share this with you because the theme of this talk is the future is in good hands. And as someone who is considered to be on the older side of her younger years, I believe we often bear a disproportionately heavy amount of weight and responsibility on our younger generations. And I don't doubt that they can carry that weight. I'm not saying that. The future is in good hands, but those hands should include all of ours together. There's a lot of work to be done out there. And if you see a system or a function of our world that you think needs changing, it's never too late to stand up and get your hands dirty and put in the hard work that to see that the world is directed towards a better path. I myself chose to follow this academic goal because of the holes that I saw in our healthcare system through caring for my own aging and passing parents. There's a lot about our healthcare system that isn't very supportive of our elders nor people of color, and neither for anybody living with a disability. And a lot of issues I've noticed are centered around our lack of awareness of the impacts that our psychological and social structures have on our long-term health and adjustment to disease. So I'm kind of constantly asking, how can we support and strengthen our psychosocial structures to improve our health outcomes? And when the pandemic hit, I kind of immediately saw a place where we might be able to do so. And that's where my research comes in. And so I'll share with you a little bit about that. So during the early days of the COVID-19 crisis, we saw a rapid move to socially isolate. And I noticed kind of what felt like a surge in self-protective thinking in America. All of this was, of course, in an effort to remain safe, right, from this deadly virus. But all through this whole pandemic, I had three main points from the World Health Organization's constitution that kept repeating in my head. And I felt that they were super important to emphasize here. The first is that the health of all peoples is fundamental to the attainment of peace and security, and that is dependent on the fullest cooperation of individuals and states. The second is that the achievement of any state in the promotion and protection of health is of value to all. And the third is that the informed opinion and active cooperation on the part of the public are the utmost importance in the improvement of the health of the people. So, if you guys know, in the early days of the pandemic, the CDC recommendations of social distancing were framed in what psychologists call avoidance terms. So these would be focusing on protecting yourself against COVID-19 by avoiding contact with others. So COVID-19 here being the negative outcome that you're trying to avoid. I was concerned that these messages might cause an already distressing and traumatic situation to be compounded with negative feelings and stress. I was also concerned about the effectiveness of these messages, seeing as following them was quintessential to our success at mitigating the virus at the time. So many theories from psychology are actually relevant to communication about our health behaviors. Scholars of motivation have long theorized that how one communicates the framing of your goals is expected to have a direct effect on the success and timely accomplishment of them. So they explain this in two ways. On one side, you have approach frame goals. So these are considered to be purpose-driven or active goals motivated by the attainment of a desired positive outcome. So for instance, someone choosing to study super hard because she wants to become a psychologist, right? So in the other direction, you have avoidance frame goals. These are explained as the avoidance of unwanted or negative outcomes. So for instance, someone who chooses to study really hard to avoid disappointing his parent. So this person is working to avoid a negative unwanted outcome. Another really wonderful theory in psychology related to health behavior change and motivation is self-transcendence theory. So self-transcendence is described as the ability to transcend outside of individualistically bound perspectives by bringing to your conscious awareness the interconnectedness between yourself, the environment, and others. And the theory of self-transcendence also suggests that creating concern for the greater good can actually increase an individual's responsiveness to new input and promote healthy behavior change. So based on self-transcendence theory, together with approach avoidance theory, I decided to research personally whether reframing our government's COVID-19 preventative procedures using the concern for the well-being of others as the underlying goal instead of protecting yourself as an individual with an approach framing might be able to increase receptivity, intentions to follow protocols, positive affect, so positive mood, and self-transcendent attitudes, so more altruistic thinking, and also possibly decrease negative affect and self-reported levels of stress experienced during the pandemic. So I collected a total of 832 highly representative participants on April 14th of 2020, and I randomly assigned them into four different groups. In each group, participants viewed a virtual health pamphlet, which I adapted directly from CDC recommendations of mitigation protocols at the time of testing. Each pamphlet had either approach or avoidance framing and either self-protective or altruistic goals embedded within the message. And immediately after viewing the pamphlet, participants completed a set of self-report surveys where they shared with me about their feelings, their perceptions, and their intentions after having read the health pamphlet. So my results showed that people in the altruistic group, so the ones who were instructed to follow our COVID-19 preventative procedures to maintain our global health, showed significantly greater intentions to follow mitigation guidelines than the participants that were in that self-protective group. Greater intentions to follow guidelines were predicted by older age, being non-male, and having less secure employment. However, there remained a significant effect of the altruistically framed messaging even after controlling for these individual differences. So I found these results highly concerning, seeing as a self-protective group was the most closely representative of the real-world messaging that was being shared from our government at the time of testing. But these results do show that there are ways that we can improve our communications to help encourage people to work together during times of global crisis like these. Our future selves would benefit from discovering ways to talk to each other to promote collective action that translate regardless of our identity politics. We also need to recognize that it's important to identify ways that we might influence the public's acceptance of our preventative guidelines, because many of our members in the community are still unvaccinated and we're still struggling on our path to reach herd immunity. This is important if we want the safe reopening of our states and to start rebuilding our economies. And it's crucial if we want to decrease the burden on our healthcare workers and to slow our growing mortality rates as well. So thank you. That's basically my research in a nutshell. I want to especially thank everyone at the Center for Undergraduate Research and Engagement at the University of Oregon and my incredible mentor, Elliot Berkman, for their help and guidance for showing me that there is an incredible amount of support out there if you are interested in getting into research, no matter of what your current life status is. People are there to help you along the way. It's been a tremendous community to be a part of. So thank you for that. And that being said, I'm going to pass the mic over to Jaira, who's going to share their research with us as well.
Thank you, Anastasia. So as Anastasia said, my name is Jaira. Hi, everyone. I am a senior here at the University of Oregon, and I have a double major in biological anthropology and linguistics with a minor in African studies. So what I do in anthropology is essentially I study what it means to be human and what makes us human. And then with linguistics, I study languages. So as a whole, I study the uniqueness of human nature and then the origins of humans as well. So here on campus, the research that I will be presenting to you today is actually my honors thesis. I'm a student in the Honors College here at the University of Oregon, and I'm also a McNair Scholar. So this served as my honors thesis and also my McNair Scholars research. So originally, I'm from Eunice, Louisiana. So just as Anastasia is a non-traditional student, I'm an out-of-state student. So coming to the University of Oregon was actually a huge dream of mine, and I'm very thankful that I was accepted at the U of O and how the Eugene community has gone and welcomed me here in Eugene, which is very nice. But today, I'll actually just go ahead and get into a little bit of what I did for my research. Okay, so the title of my thesis is essentially quantifying cranial shape change with age in adult modern humans through a geometric morphometric approach. Now that does sound very technical, so I'm actually gonna break this down. So cranial shape change, basically what I'm looking at is how your skull changes shape once you reach adulthood. So I'm defining adulthood from age 20 up until the time of your demise. I know that kind of sounds a little morbid, but that is what I was looking at. So normally skeletal ontogenetic changes or skeletal developmental changes are seen within the prenatal stages. So when you are conceived and within the womb and growing up until subadult stages. So I'm defining subadult stages as from age 17 to 19. So again, I'm looking from 20 up until demise. And then also they're mainly looked in the postcrania. So the postcrania is actually everything from your neck down. So the cranium is its own thing, and then everything else is its own monster as well. So the skull actually has its own ways of identifying age within humans. So you can look at tooth eruption. So whenever your teeth come in, like for toddlers, their teeth normally come in at about one, and then they continue through their teen years, and then you should be getting your molars at around like your mid-20s for some people. Some of them get them a little earlier. Also, tooth wear. So as we use our teeth with eating, as we go to the dentist to kind of remodel our teeth if they're broken, if we have cavities or anything like that, that's also an indicator of age. And lastly, it would be suture fusion. So on your skull, you actually have these little lines. You can think of them as like cracks in the concrete. And if they are fused, then that means that you have a particular age that it corresponds with. So essentially what I was looking at with my research was what other features are there for a crania if I don't have any teeth, or if the suture, if it's in pieces. So I can use this research to do forensic anthropology, which is essentially looking at if there are remains found at a crime scene. I can use this research to do that. I can also use it for paleoanthropology, which is looking at our hominid or fossil ancestors. I use the Terry Collection. So the Terry Collection is a collection by Dr. Robert J. Terry. He was a professor at St. Louis, Missouri. And what he did was essentially compile a collection of individuals. So these were non-consenting individuals, and I want to make sure I highlight that. Non-consenting essentially means that they did not donate their body to science willingly. So there's also one person who is a consenting individual, who's Dr. Grover Krantz. He actually was a professor for biological anthropology, and he donated his body to this research. So that's important to note and give acknowledgement to the specimens that I used, because they were real people. And even past their death, they continue to educate us to this day. So for my research, I had a sample of about 13 specimens. The youngest individual was 34, and the oldest individual was 71 years old. So what I did was I actually used a process called photogrammetry, where I took photographs of the skull. So this is kind of cool, to where you can use an everyday phone or an everyday camera and take pictures of a specimen. Then you can digitize those photos and make 3D models out of those specimens. So I had about 100 photo scans of each specimen, so from a top view or a superior view, and then an inferior view or a bottom view. So after I had the digitized images of those specimens, I actually got to do a fun technique called cranial landmarking. So cranial landmarking is essentially, if you're thinking of a location drop pin or like directions on a map, normally they have a point that says you are here. So that is one landmark. And then your distance to another landmark or another drop pin, that is the distance that I was looking at. On your head, if you were to touch your nose and then touch your cheekbone, that would be a landmark of you touching your nose and then a landmark of you touching your cheekbone. So what I essentially did from here was use these landmarks to kind of create a visualization of the trajectory of where these landmarks would move. So again, we can use our nose and little cheekbone analogy. So if you would think about it, if you had your finger on your nose and then a finger on the tiny little cheekbone that is right next to it, those points actually move as you age. So if it's a solid dot, if you can think of it as an arrow, so essentially your landmark on your nose is there, but as you age, as you progress through age, they actually move kind of slightly to the left or slightly to the right. So that's actually what I was looking for. And I did find that there was a 5.6 degree of variance. So your skull does change shape as you age, which is great, because this actually contributes to the scientific community in biological anthropology that there are other features of shape change other than just tooth eruption, tooth wear, or suture fusion. So basically a extenuation of this research is to use this for forensic anthropology. So this can be used to help age individuals from unsolved cases who they have remains that are unidentified. Also, we can use this in paleoanthropology to kind of better understand the differences and correlations between modern humans and our hominid ancestors. So when I say our hominid ancestors, I'm meaning like Neanderthals who are Homo Neanderthalus or any of the other Homo species, because we are Homo sapiens. So that is the total summary of what I did with my research. And I will actually be extending on this. I am going into a PhD program at the University of Texas at Austin after I graduate here at the U of O in June. And so I will be taking this undergraduate thesis with me and kind of revamping it into a more dissertation-y master's type of research. And I wouldn't have been able to do that without the help of the University of Oregon and the McNair Scholars Program, because they let a person of color who was also a female like me get involved in research as early as I could and stick with it, because it's very hard to come as an out-of-state student, just as Anastasia was speaking about being a non-traditional student, to really get involved and find that support. But thanks to the University of Oregon, McNair Scholars Program, and also the Primate Morphometric Laboratory in the Anthropology Department, I've been able to win awards with this research and also take my research elsewhere. that is my research, and that is my little spiel about everything. So I can go ahead and turn it over to Jude.
Thanks, Tyra. Yeah, hi, my name is Jude Stone, and I am also a senior at the University of Oregon, fourth year, and I'm studying political science, and I'm minoring in legal studies, queer studies, and theater arts. And like the two of them, I am also an out-of-state student. And the thing that really brought me to this research is that when I was growing up, I faced a lot of transphobia from the superintendents of my high school. And, you know, while I fought for equal treatment in every way that I could, I just didn't have, you know, the legal backing for people like me. And so ever since then, I've been really passionate about creating legal and political equity for marginalized people, particularly for trans people. And so now I work as the education and activism coordinator of the LGBTQA3 Alliance at the University of Oregon. And I'm also interning with the Oregon Justice Resource Center while we're working on a lawsuit against the Oregon Department of Corrections for how they've mishandled treating COVID for incarcerated people in Oregon. And I'm also interning with OSPIRG Students, which stands for Oregon Students Public Interest Research Group. And we work on public interest issues through grassroots activism on things like the environment and college affordability. And I'm excited to work with them next year. Once I graduate, I'll be the campus organizer at the University of Oregon. So I'm excited to stay a part of the UO community. But just before I dive into my research, I just want to give listeners a heads up that my topic is about racist and anti-trans murders. So I just want to be mindful that that's a heavy topic and not everyone might be in the space to listen to that. So I just want to give folks a heads up. But my research is really looking at two primary issues. So I'm looking at how BIPOC trans femme people, so to break that down a little bit, BIPOC stands for Black Indigenous People of Color, and trans femme people, here I'm defining as people who were assigned male at birth, but identified as trans women or as gender nonconforming people. So that could be non-binary or drag queens, two-spirit, and so on. So BIPOC trans femme people are killed at absurdly high rates in the United States. And the way that the law treats trans people establishes a culture of devaluing their lives. And, you know, whether it's through police brutality or through legal discrimination. And then the other issue that I was looking at was that BIPOC men are policed, arrested, and incarcerated at obscene rates. You know, previous studies have already shown that BIPOC men, particularly Black and Latino men, are routinely criminalized and treated worse than white people throughout every aspect of the legal system. So what I was looking at was how courts policed each of these groups, BIPOC trans femme people and BIPOC men, on either side of a case, right? So with the trans femme person being the victim and the BIPOC men being the defendants. And here I use victim in the legal sense only. I don't want to label these trans femme people as victims in any other context because it erases the agency and resistance that they have. But my primary research question was looking at how does race impact homicide convictions of trans femme people. So depending on both the defendant's and the victim's race, how does that affect who is convicted and what conviction they receive? So really quick, before I talk about what I found, I just want to give a little bit of background. The law is used to maintain social order by criminalizing certain groups of people as deviant. So the law heavily associates queer people, and specifically trans people, with narratives that paint them as sexually depraved, deceitful, mentally deranged, and predatory. And that's especially true for BIPOC trans femme people. And likewise, the law also casts BIPOC men as criminals, as thugs, lazy, hypersexual, and hyperviolent. And what's really important is that those narratives are not independent of each other. Historically, the US has defined queerness and race simultaneously and in relation to one another, and it still does today. So that helps explain why BIPOC trans femme people in particular are targeted by so much violence and dehumanization. And the other piece of background I want to give is that criminal law allows people to exploit biased narratives. So lawyers use criminalizing narratives to dehumanize both the trans femme victims and the BIPOC defendants, depending on which side they're representing. And studies have consistently shown that both judges and juries are actually heavily influenced by these narratives and their implicit biases, which everyone has. So for my methods, I used legal databases, news articles and broadcasts, and court files, as well as texts on race and queer theory. And I looked at every trans femme homicide case since the passage of the 2009 Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. So 103 cases in total, and that number is much smaller than the amount of trans femme people who are killed, of course, because There's a lot of misreporting when the victims are misgendered, and also there's a lot of times where the perpetrator is never found, reasons like that. And unfortunately, due to the data sizes, I could only analyze trends about Black, Latinx, and white subjects because there were not enough cases that involved Indigenous, Asian, Pacific Islander, and Middle Eastern subjects to identify a trend with those races. But for my results, I found that of the 103 cases, only 4 of those cases received hate crime charges. And of those, only 3 actually yielded hate crime convictions. And then of those 3, one of them was on the basis of race, not gender identity, and the other was later overturned. So ultimately, only one case out of 103 cases with transfemme victims resulted in a hate crime conviction, even though many defendants openly admitted that they killed the transfemme person because they, quote, snapped when they found out that they were trans. And another big finding is that compared to the national average, the defendants accused of murdering transfemme people were twice as likely to go to trial rather than accept a plea deal. So what that means basically is that when someone is charged with a crime, they can plead guilty or not guilty. And if they plead guilty, then they can usually take a plea deal, which means that they will get a less harsh conviction or sentence for admitting their guilt right out of the gate. But if they plead not guilty, then they go to trial and they risk being convicted much more harshly because they wouldn't get that plea deal, but they also maintain the chance that they would be found not guilty and go free. So nationally, only 25% of defendants risk trial for homicide cases. But this study found that of the defendants accused of killing transfemme people, 53% of them risked trial. That's over twice as many. So coupled with the amount of transphobia that we see in the criminal legal system, this suggests that defendants may have intentionally exploited their victim's gender identity to reduce or beat convictions. And the other findings that I found specifically pertaining to race was that the victim's race had a bigger influence on the conviction that cases received than the defendant's race. So trials with Black transfemme victims yielded the lowest conviction rates. And of those that ended in conviction, those with Black victims received lower degrees of conviction. Whereas cases with Latina transfemme victims yielded actually the same conviction rate as those with white transfemme victims, but Latina victims yielded lower rates of murder convictions specifically, so less harsh convictions. And predictably, cases with white transfemme victims yielded the harshest convictions overall, regardless of the defendant's race. But I did find that the defendant's race still did matter because Black defendants received harsher convictions than Latinx or white defendants when the victims' races were held constant. So ultimately, you know, this aligns with previous studies in terms of the breakdown of convictions by race, in that Blackness is extremely devalued in the United States and especially in the criminal legal system. And being Latinx is certainly criminalized more than whiteness as well. And whiteness is socially valued the most. And this is particularly amplified in cases with transfemme people, where Black transfemme victims seem to receive the least amount of sympathy from judges and juries, whereas white transfemme victims seem to receive the most. So I also want to thank the many mentors and supporters that I had for helping me with this research. And specifically, I want to thank the Center for Undergraduate Research and Engagement, as well as the Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program and the Clark Honors College for funding my research, as well as providing me countless opportunities to grow and better my academic career and beyond.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our Facebook page for more topics. We hope you are inspired to join us for our next podcast episode.